Having recently made the decision to write a memoir, I've developed a profound interest in the art of storytelling. And this interest led me to your YouTube channel, and after discovering that you accept viewer submissions, I decided to send over a chapter for your perusal. It concerns events which took place on the Akwesasne Mohawk Reservation in upstate New York back in 1981 when I was still an agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I graduated from Quantico in late 1980, and since all my family is based in Queens, my first choice of posting was always going to be the Bureau's Manhattan field office. Once we got the good news, my then girlfriend, now ex-wife, and I were delighted at not having to move across the country and began my tenure following the holiday period. Since I was fresh out of training, I hadn't been given a field assignment yet, and was stuck shadowing more experienced agents until the assistant director was confident that I could do my job. New agents undergo what's called the field training program, which, as I already mentioned, involves shadowing and learning from much more experienced agents. But with it typically lasting several months, I didn't expect to be given my own assignment until the summer or early fall. Yet as it transpired, the assistant director had other plans. One morning he called me into his office and asked how I was finding things thus far. And becoming an FBI agent had been my primary ambition since I first saw the taking of Pelham 123 back when I was in middle school. And so to be there in person, it really was a dream come true. And when I told him that, he just nodded and sort of thought a little, then asked the very last question that I could possibly expect him to. "Do you think you're ready for an assignment?" And the question prompted a wave of emotion. I felt honored, flattered, and, if I'm honest, a little apprehensive. But above all, I was ecstatic at the prospect of receiving an assignment so early on in my career. I knew it could make or break me, and you can bet that I was feeling the pressure of that. But I was young and foolish enough to believe that I could handle any task I was given. So, in response to the assistant director's question, I told him, "Yes," and got my briefing there and then. The assistant director told me that he'd been reading my personnel file and had noticed the Mohawk ancestry on my mother's side. He asked me how familiar I was with Mohawk history, and after I told him that I was somewhat knowledgeable on the subject, he asked how much I knew about the St. Regis Mohawk Reservation up in Franklin County. I'd heard of it, but having grown up on the opposite side of the state and having no family there to speak of, I had to be honest and say that I'd never visited and didn't know much about the place. When I assured him that I could be up to speed in no time, he replied that he had no doubt that that was true. That wasn't why I'd been chosen for the assignment that he had in mind. The issue wasn't knowledge. It was trust. As you might already be aware, there's a lot of complexity to the issue of law enforcement on reservations. State police officers have no authority on the reservations whatsoever, meaning the job of enforcing the law comes down to tribal police forces. But every so often, when tribal police come across something a little too big for them to handle, they call in the FBI. In the case of the St. Regis Reservation, or as its denizens call it, Akwesasne, they hadn't contacted the FBI for more than 10 years, and the last time they did, it hadn't ended well. The assistant director told me that back in the late 60s, the FBI had been unable to solve a missing persons case involving a 17-year-old girl named Harper Tarbell, and the fiasco had left a very bad taste in the mouths of the Mohawk. Investigating agents concluded that Harper was a runaway, but the inhabitants of the reservation, tribal police force included, were very vocal in their belief that the girl had been abducted. They accused the FBI of not investigating the case properly, but according to the file, the geography of the St. Regis Reservation made the agent's task an extremely difficult one. You see, the St. Regis section of the reservation is in the United States, but the vast majority of the Akwesasne Mohawk territory is on the other side of the border, in Canada. That means the Canadian side of the reservation has a different police force than our side, and at least in the 60s, They made very little effort to share information, conduct joint patrols, or secure the integrity of the international border. It's probably the last part which most frustrated the two FBI agents, as it was the unofficial policy of all parties that the border remain open to anyone who called themselves a resident of the greater Akwesasne territory. But this meant that the agents had no idea whether their missing girl had run north or south, and given how often native girls with rough home lives run away from their families, it became the Bureau's official position that Harper Tarbell was a runaway and that there was no evidence of foul play. In response, tribal police offered the agents a very sarcastic thank you and then invited them to leave the reservation at their earliest possible convenience. Once I was beginning to understand the difficulties of my potential assignment, the assistant director asked if I was sure that I wanted to take it. Before I had a chance to answer, he reassured me that I'd get all the help that I could possibly ask for when it came to the office's resources and personnel. But to use the man's own words, "You're the face of this thing, no one else." To make a good impression with the locals, they wanted to send a Mohawk, and that Mohawk was me. That way, when I told people that I was there because I cared, and I wasn't just there for a paycheck, it would come off as much more sincere, and it needed to come off sincere because this was a very important and very sensitive case. It was a daunting prospect, and I don't feel nearly so confident once the precariousness of the situation became clear, but it still presented a golden opportunity to get a step up on the career ladder, and very early on, too, and so I took it. It was about a 6-hour drive from Manhattan to a place called Hogansburg, the largest town in the reservation, at least on the American side, and the location of Tribal Police HQ. When I arrived, I met with the chief of police at a diner across the precinct called the Bear's Den. They did an amazing steak hash, which was much appreciated after that long journey, and as we ate, the chief gave me a brief introduction to the reservation and its people. He really talked the place up, and while it isn't unusual for someone to love where they're from, the chief said his praise had a purpose. He was telling me that so when I opened up that file and read what had happened there, I'd remember that there were good, hard-working, level-headed people on that reservation that merely wanted to get to the bottom of a very grisly crime. Again, this was a somewhat daunting introduction, but he was absolutely right to warn me. Because when I got back to the $3-a-night motel that I was staying in and read what was in that file, it made my blood run cold. Less than a week before my arrival, one of the reservation's many farmers woke up before dawn and walked out into his fields to begin his morning work. Then, as he's feeding some of his animals, he sees a figure walking up his pathway in the early morning. It's a young girl, 11 years old to be exact, and as she's getting closer, the farmer realizes that from head to toe, she was covered in blood. Being of advanced age, the farmer said it quite literally almost scared him to death. He thought it was a spirit come to take him to the other place, and he was shaking in his boots right up until she asked him, in plain but very accented English, to help her. And the farmer rushes back inside to his house and calls 911, then by the time he runs back outside, the girl's lying in the dirt, drifting in and out of consciousness. And the last thing she says before she passes out for a whole 12 hours is that she came from the river, meaning she walked just over 3 miles, soaked to the bone and freezing cold, before collapsing in our farmer's pathway. The paramedics rushed to the young girl's aid and then drove her straight to the medical clinic there in Hogansburg for life-saving treatment. And then once they got her there, they realized all that blood wasn't even hers. Apart from a few abrasions here and there, there was barely a scratch on her. Then after hearing that the girl mentioned the river, the tribal police enlisted the help of the reservation's paramedics in scouring the banks of the nearby St. Regis River, particularly the section nearest to our farmer's humble patch of dirt. And it didn't take long for them to find out where all that blood had come from. Out there on the riverbank, hanging in the trees, were the mutilated bodies of five men. All had been disemboweled, their entrails hanging 4 or 5 feet to the ground from where they'd been impaled on broken branches or nestled grotesquely among the beams. Once the tribal police had gone about analyzing the crime scene and transporting the victims' bodies for secure storage, the chief of police stopped into the medical center to talk to that girl. She was awake, and the chief tried his best to pry any information he could from her, but she was in no condition to discuss her ordeal, and she only made it through 4 or 5 questions before she suffered a complete nervous breakdown. She said her name was Sarah, that she was 11 years old and she was from Quebec City. But when the chief asked her what had happened down by the river, she started to lock up. And then, with tears welling up in her eyes, she told the chief, "It was something in the river. Something in the river killed them." And after that, she was inconsolable, and was in no fit state to be interviewed again for another couple of days. Before then, the tribal police got a preliminary analysis back from the Franklin County Coroner's Office, and the results were interesting, to say the least. Each of the bodies had been heavily mutilated, so much so that the exact causes of death were impossible to determine. In each of their mouths, the coroner found a small amount of what was later determined to be ceremonial pipe tobacco. Pipe tobacco is used by many First Nations people for spiritual, cultural, and ceremonial purposes. It's used in prayer, where the smoke from pipe carries prayers to the spiritual realm, and it's also used at various coming-of-age ceremonies, or even weddings and funerals. But pipe tobacco serves another purpose, that of purification and spiritual restoration. And the significance of its presence in the victims' mouths wasn't immediately obvious, but as one of the tribal police officers told me, it was most likely there to banish the victims' restless spirits and prevent them from clinging to the land. Obviously, at that stage, the tribal police knew they had something big on their hands, but whether or not the case could be handled internally hinged on what the little girl from Quebec had to say once she was finally able to talk. They had her staying in the medical center in Hogansburg, and although she hadn't said much in the meantime, her condition spoke quite a bit. Some of the tribal police officers had this idea that maybe the whole thing was some kind of camping trip gone wrong, that maybe a group of old friends had been out canoeing on the river, and that one of them had snapped. When they got the news that the girl was showing signs of malnourishment, that kind of played into the officer's theory. The group were canoeing in the river, they got lost, ran out of food, and then snap. One of the group flies off the handle, attacks everyone, then little Sarah somehow escapes in the ensuing chaos. But once the girl was ready to talk again, she turned that whole theory on its head. The moment the chief of tribal police heard little Sarah was talking again, he rushed over to the medical center with one of his officers to take her statement. But upon their arrival, they were shocked to hear that the men that she was with were not her family, or friends of her family, or anything like that at all. At some point over the previous few weeks, she wasn't exactly sure when, Sarah had been snatched off the street in Quebec City. The men that she was with had abducted her, and were in the process of transporting her someplace when the thing came out of the river and saved her. The chief pressed her as much as possible on what exactly came out of the river, but Sarah didn't know. She'd been blindfolded and placed into some kind of large sack prior to the first leg of the journey, but had been removed from the bag and placed into some kind of boat. And the boat had been driven for some undetermined period of time, then it stopped and she was guided into the shallows. But as soon as her feet touched the water, the men escorting her became alarmed, began yelling, and then gunfire began to erupt just a few feet from her. She said that there was a lot of gunfire, so much it almost sounded like one solid wall of noise hitting her ears, making her deaf. The men who'd abducted her tried to kill the thing that attacked them, screaming, cursing, and yelling as it tore them apart, and in the chaos as it unfolded, she pulled off her blindfold and escaped into the darkness of the early morning. Sarah said that she had no idea where she was or where she was headed, but as dawn started to creep onto the horizon, she saw an old farmhouse and began walking towards it. And once word got out, that's about the time folks started talking about the spirit of the river. Many native cultures have a myth surrounding river gods or river spirits, but for the most part, these spirits are passive and unconcerned by the affairs of man. However, once news of the girl's kidnap made its way around the reservation, it became clear that many believed that the spirit of the river had felt young Sarah's pain and had decided to do something about it. This is especially true after two aspects of the case were leaked by an unidentified member of the tribal police. Firstly, the news that ceremonial tobacco had been found in the mouths of the victims only strengthened people's belief that something supernatural was at play. But it was the second detail that really creeped out the reservation's residents. By that point, around a dozen tribal police officers had observed the scene of the crime, as had several members of emergency medical services. All of them confirmed that covering the riverbank near the location of those bodies were a ton of dead river fish. There were brown trout, walleyes, muskies, panfish, all lying there like some lifeless carpet made of shimmering scales. And just like with the ceremonial tobacco, their presence only seemed to reinforce the idea that the kidnappers were killed by the spirit of the river. But to me, the explanation seemed much more simpler. You see, my father was a Vietnam veteran, and although he hadn't talked much about what he did during the war, there was something that he once told me that I never forgot. He said the Viet Cong were master ambushers and never attacked a patrol when they expected to be attacked. They waited until what my dad called moments of transition, when his platoon was least prepared, and that's when they attacked. For example, the VC would choose to hit my dad's unit during helicopter departures, during sentry changes in the middle of the night, or perhaps their favorite, during river crossings. Whoever ambushed Sarah's abductors did so during a moment of transition, and had done so with such effectiveness that all five victims never stood a chance. I put this theory to the chief of police, who, to an extent, agreed with my analysis of the crime scene. There was just one problem. During the preliminary examination of the bodies, the Franklin County coroner saw no sign of entry or exit wounds on any of the bodies, meaning, if they had been ambushed, it wasn't with any kind of firearm. There were, however, plenty of indications that the men had been killed using a sharp or bladed instrument. But if that was the case, how had a group of men armed with nothing but knives managed to best a group of five firearm-toting people smugglers? And the chief also mentioned that the reservation had a kind of small-town mentality to it. Even though it was spread over a wide area and included multiple small towns and villages, everyone knew everyone else's business. Tribal police had also issued an appeal for information, and with the level of trust between the force and their people being so high, the fact that no one came forward was very concerning. They never had the problem before. Someone always came through with a tip or some information, especially if it was for the good of the reservation. Outsiders were pretty focused to exploit the place's legal loopholes, but the reservation's denizens were just as focused to keep that from happening. So the fact that no one came forward seemed to be proof that no one knew anything, which again, for a place like a reservation, was deeply troubling. And it was around here that the tribal police hit their investigative brick wall, so to speak, and after some debate, they contacted the FBI's New York field office and requested assistance. By the time I arrived, the abducted Canadian girl had been returned to her parents in Quebec City for what I can only assume was a very happy reunion. I had dinner with the chief of tribal police, took the case file back to my motel room, then the next morning, I drove over to the precinct to talk with the chief and his officers. The first thing I did, in an attempt to reestablish trust between the Bureau and the tribal police, was ask them where and how we could assist them in their investigation. I wasn't there to take over and shove them aside, like you see in almost every other police drama on television. I was there to supercharge whatever they were doing with the Bureau's deep pockets and fancy equipment. They seemed appreciative, albeit a little skeptical of the help that I had to offer them, but they were not without requests. First off, the coroner over in Franklin County was so understaffed that they couldn't give the tribe a definitive date for the completion of all five autopsies. Given they needed the results to advance the investigation, the first thing I could do was help expedite the autopsies. The second thing I could do was get some FBI forensics guys to look over the crime scene again, as all they'd be able to do thus far was look it over with the naked eye. Don't get me wrong, they'd done a real good job with what little they had, but they needed divers for the river, and they needed someone to figure out who the hell their victims actually were, which would involve setting up a direct line of communication with the police up in Quebec and Ontario. It was a lot of work, but I had the backing of the Bureau, and within days, I was able to deliver the first result. After a phone call back to HQ, two forensic pathologists from the New York field office drove up to the coroner's office in Malone. The folks there were only too happy to let them do their jobs for them, and it meant that we had our autopsy results by late afternoon that same day. Preliminary examinations hadn't found a single verifiable gunshot wound on any of the bodies, but the autopsy results showed that they were riddled with them. One body had almost 30 cavitations running through his torso alone, meaning almost 30 bullets had punched through his chest and stomach before exiting through the flesh of his back. The sheer volume and devastation of this gunfire suggested that either the smugglers had been attacked by a large group of lightly armed men, or by a much smaller group armed with high-powered machine guns. To the tribal police, both explanations proved hard to swallow. They couldn't believe a large group of armed men had been running around the reservation without word getting back to them, and when it came to heavy machine guns, no one on the reservation had that kind of firepower. Then, when the forensic analysis of the scene came in, it only sort of deepened the mystery. And so, remember all those dead fish that had creeped everyone out so much? The ceremonial pipe tobacco in the victims' mouths were one thing, but how did we expect to explain all those dead fish lining the shore? Well, the mystery of all those dead fish was solved in tandem with the mystery of where the smuggler's boat had gotten to. It was at the bottom of the river, complete with a few sacks stuffed with bullet-punctured bags of Afghan heroin. All of those fish had been swimming around the boat, breathing an uncut heroin that had been leaching into the water and then floating to the surface and toward the riverbank, dead as doornails. But what investigators couldn't understand was why there was a single 7.62x57 Mauser shell casing, a rare old pattern bullet first introduced prior to World War I, lying among a sea of 9mm and .45. The discovery of the heroin raised the question if the murders were committed by a rival group, or if the incident itself was some kind of drug deal gone wrong. This theory was reinforced when Ontario police reached out to confirm that multiple Canadian smuggling operations used the waterways of the Akwesasne territory to transport goods across the border to the United States, and then naturally, their direct competition sometimes led to confrontations. But there was something about the presence of the pipe tobacco in their mouths that made me think that there was much more to it than that. Some of the tribal police suggested it could have been placed there to throw investigators off the scent and make them focus on the local Mohawk rather than on the international smuggling outfits. I can understand making an example of them by mutilating the bodies, but why go to the trouble of procuring ceremonial tobacco and why bother to place it in such an exact spot as opposed to tossing a handful of it over the bodies once they'd been cut up and hung? No. To me, it was no decoy or distraction. It had been done with intent and forethought, meaning the killers were on the reservation. Then when it came to the question of who might be motivated enough to do such a thing, I knew damn sure who I wanted to talk to first. Before I continue, I feel like this is the right time to explain something very important. In some people's vision of an ideal world, the FBI wouldn't investigate a case wherein five smugglers of child captives were murdered, with their prisoner having escaped without a scratch. But there's a reason vigilante justice is illegal in this country. From the perspective of an investigator, we had no idea who these people were. Sure, a few of them could have been people smugglers, but all of them? And what if that little girl Sarah from Quebec wasn't the only child on board the boat that night? There could be bodies still unaccounted for, and vulnerable, trafficked individuals could have been murdered along with their kidnappers in a case of mistaken identity. That's why we had to get to the bottom of what had happened, and why we couldn't just say, "Oh well, scratch 5 scumbags, and then clock out early for cold beers and shrimp cocktails." The first and only person on my list of people to talk to was Wolf Tarbell, the father of the missing Harper Tarbell, who disappeared 15 years prior. He was a disabled veteran of World War II, living alone off his army pension on a piece of untilled farmland his family had owned for generations. At first, after limping out of his home with the use of a cane, he refused to answer any of my questions, and frankly, I completely understood why. But I told him not only had I brought news that would vindicate his claims of his daughter's abduction, but there was a chance that we could make the men that took her face justice for their crime. And after that, he warmed up to me considerably and invited me into his home. The first thing Mr. Tarbell did after I walked inside was show me a picture of his missing daughter. He told me that he thought of her every single day, and her memory was the only thing that got him out of bed every morning. He asked me if I'd ever lost somebody like that, and I said no. He said that he hoped that I never had to know what it felt like. And then, and only then, did he agree to talk about the smugglers. As it went, Mr. Tarbell had conducted considerable research into the cross-border smuggling networks of the Akwesasne. A series of competing factions smuggled cigarettes, drugs, firearms, and even people back and forth across the border, and Mr. Tarbell was quite certain that it was one of these factions which abducted his daughter. He obviously didn't have any concrete proof, and he had no idea where his daughter had been taken, or even if she was still alive. But if he knew it had to be one of those groups, and he was only too willing to help me if it meant seeing them in handcuffs. And I thanked him for everything he told me, said I'd take his advice regarding better communication with the cops on the Canadian side of the border, and then made my way to the Hogansburg police precinct to tell the chief what I'd learned. He didn't seem surprised Mr. Tarbell had spent so much time fixated on the subject, but he was surprised that he'd taken the time to talk to me. The chief claimed Wolf Tarbell had once said that the next FBI man who stepped foot onto his property would be buried on it, so the fact that I even made it off his land alive was something of a miracle. Over the days that followed, myself and the officers of the tribal police tried to build a picture of the regional smuggling operation, and we primarily achieved this after securing the cooperation of police departments up in Quebec and Ontario, who explained it had been a problem on their side for quite some time. The transnational nature of the territory meant that it had always been an issue. But from the early 70s onwards, cross-border narcotics and people smuggling had become a huge problem for communities on both sides of the U.S.-Canadian border. And that made for one hell of a day's work, and by the end of it, we had 2 separate link charts on 2 separate cork boards, one for English-speaking groups and the other for the French-Canadian groups. Most seemed to specialize in either drugs or firearms, rarely both, but the ones we were interested in were to the ones that transported people. But to our frustration, they were much, much harder to pin down, because cases involving human trafficking were much less common. And like I said, that made for a tough day, so before I went to my motel room, I stopped by the Bear's Den Diner for more of their steak hash. And it was close to closing time, and I was the only person in there, but the owner seemed only too happy to make me his final customer of the evening. Once I'd finished eating, he brought me a cup of coffee on the house. He'd heard about what had happened down by the river and figured that I must be one of the out-of-town cops come to help solve the case. I told him with powers of deduction like that, he should have been a detective, and after what I'm sure was a very polite return of laughter, he asked how the investigation was going. And I said it was going okay, permitting a few speed bumps, and that when all was said and done, it might make a real difference in terms of putting a dent in local crime. The diner's owner then said he doubted that very much on account of the incompetence of the local police force. And out of courtesy, I just asked him what he meant by that. And as I sipped my free coffee, he explained that sometimes the local cops didn't respond to calls at all. One night, just a week prior or so, the owner of the diner had taken a bathroom trip in the middle of the night. He hadn't been keeping regular as he'd like to in his old age, so while it was a relief to have nature finally calling, he remained atop the old porcelain throne for quite some time before he properly finished his business. But during that period, in dead silence of the winter night, he thought that he heard a loud burst of gunfire way off in the distance, and then another, and then another. He said he wasn't completely sure what he'd heard at the time, but the next day, when news of the murder swept the town, he called the tribal police to file a report on what he'd heard. The officer that he had spoken to said that he'd make a note of the call and then inform the chief at the first available opportunity, but he never got a return call. When I asked the chief why I hadn't been informed of this, he said it was the first that he was hearing of it and that an officer, Tyler Wynn, had been manning the desk that day. Wynn, on the other hand, offered little more than a weak apology and said that he'd been tired following the extra early start that day. I didn't see it as too much of a setback or a missed opportunity or anything, but I did think that it was odd that an officer would neglect to record something of such significance. The next few days were quite slow, with only minute progress here and there, thanks to calls from departments up in Canada. But then, a sudden break in the case sent everyone scrambling. We got a call from an antique firearms dealer over in New Hampshire, who, having heard the press release we put out regarding the automatic weapons used in the Riverside murders, had reached out to the FBI to report an unusual sale. His antique dealership specialized in weaponry and equipment from World War II, and while he made a few bucks here and there from antique weapon sales, he made a lot of money selling what you might call historical ammunition, or stuff they don't make anymore. About 3 or 4 months before the murders, he gets a phone order for an entire case of 7.62x57 Mauser ammo, and not blank rounds either, live ones. And if you remember, one of the shell casings found at the scene of the crime had been of this exact same rare caliber. The antiques dealer used to do a lot of business with reenactors, you know the kind. They dress up in old uniforms and then go running around a field pretending to shoot at each other and then pretending to die. They always needed a whole bunch of old-fashioned ammunition for their reenactments, so the guy made a lot of money off of it, and whenever he sold actual live rounds of 7.62x57, it was only ever a few boxes to target shooters, not whole cases. Just a few days before the murders, when the guy came to pick the ammo up, he arrived in a car with New York plates, walked with a limp, and although he never said it out loud, our antiques dealer was for damn sure that the guy was a veteran. It was Wolf Tarbell. It had to be. As soon as I got off the phone with the antiques dealer, which was fairly late in the evening, I called the chief of police and then arranged for us to pay Mr. Tarbell a visit the following morning. Since he was now considered a person of interest, I didn't want to tip him off that we were planning on stopping by. Yet, little did I know, he wouldn't have been able to come to the phone anyway. When myself and the chief arrived at his home the next morning, Wolf Tarbell's front door was wide open, and when I called out for him, I didn't get a reply. The chief and I drew our sidearms and then crept into Tarbell's house, not quite knowing what to expect, but knowing that it was going to be bad. Then, when we walked into the man's kitchen, we found him. I'd seen the crime photos from the River murders already, and what was left of Wolf Tarbell looked exactly like the remains in those photographs. He was all torn up, butchered almost beyond recognition. Someone had taken his head and then placed it horizontally on a kitchen counter. Tarbell's jaw was a little slack, and inside his mouth, I could see a clump of something dark and damp behind his front teeth. It was ceremonial pipe tobacco, the same kind that had been found in the mouths of the victims by the river. The chief called for backup using his patrol car's radio, and within the hour, his officers had locked down the crime scene and forensics were en route. But as the first of the chief's officers arrived, we got word that Officer Wynn had failed to show up to work that day, which, given the recent spike of murders, was obviously very concerning. Tyler Wynn was the same slow but well-meaning officer who failed to log the call that one time. The chief said that he lived with his mother in a small home just outside of Hogansburg. But when the chief and I stopped by, He wasn't there either. As the chief asked his mother, who was a very warm and very cooperative older lady, where she thought that her son might be, I found my eyes starting to kind of wander around the room. Mrs. Wynn had hung framed pictures of her family on just about every visible surface, including plenty of her police officer's son, Tyler. I got kind of a kick out of getting to see him grow up in fast motion, as the photos ranged from baby pictures to elementary school age to late high school and graduation. But there was one picture in particular that really caught my eye, and that's because I recognized both of the photo's two subjects. It looked like it was taken during some kind of winter formal, and showed a sophomore or junior year age Tyler standing with a young lady who looked very, very familiar. At the next opportunity, I politely interrupted the chief and Mrs. Wynn to ask who the girl in the photograph was, and a sad look came over her face before she told me, "That's Harper Tarbell. Tyler was real sweet on her back in his high school days. The two dated, even went to a dance together, and he was heartbroken when she went missing." The chief and I were stunned, but him more so because in almost 10 years of working with Officer Wynn, he never once mentioned having dated the missing Tarbell girl. But that wasn't the only odd thing that the chief had noticed about Officer Wynn. On the night of the River murders, Wynn had radioed into HQ claiming that he'd followed a bunch of outsiders back to some kind of illegal alcohol still that they had set up on the edge of the reservation. Because he was still on the move, he only gave a rough idea of his location and direction, but then suddenly, he starts yelling about how they'd spotted their tail, and it opened fire on him, then he drops off his radio entirely. Every tribal officer on duty, and even some that were off duty, go roaring off towards Wynn's last known location, and when I asked where that was, the chief told me that it was just about as far away from the scene of the River murders as it was possible to be, and still be inside the reservation. The only trouble was, when they arrived in the area in question and started scouring it for any sign of Wynn and the trigger-happy bootleggers, they can't find hide nor hair of either party, and they only find Wynn much later on back at that station, claiming that he outran those gunmen and saved his own skin. The chief didn't tell me all that until we were back in his car, and we were on our way to the fishing shack Wynn's mother claimed that he liked to frequent. She claimed it's where she'd look if she was in charge of looking for him, and she was right. Inside of that rickety old fishing shack, the mutilated corpse of Officer Tyler Wynn was spread all over the wooden walls and floor, and I'm sure by this stage I don't have to tell you what had been stuffed into his mouth. Also present inside the shack was a little plastic baggie containing all the 7.62x57 shell casings that were missing from the scene of the rivers, all except for one, of course. And the question of what they'd been fired from was answered following a thorough search of Wolf Tarbell's property. After being wounded during the Battle of Bastogne, Wolf Tarbell returned home with more than just a Purple Heart. For some reason, he was allowed to keep the rifle that he'd fought with upon his discharge, and after registering it with the tribal police, it took a prideful place above his mantle. But what the army didn't know is that the old wounded wolf had brought home another weapon with him, broken down into pieces and concealed among his belongings. He reassembled it in his basement when he got home, and that's where it stayed for more than 35 years, an almost mint-condition, German-made Maschinengewehr 42, more commonly known as the MG-42. We had an idea of who had provided the weapon. We had an idea of who had pulled the trigger. We also had an idea of why our killer had pulled the trigger, seeing as his childhood sweetheart had apparently been abducted by the same organization the victims were members of. But what we couldn't work out, what I've never been able to work out, is who killed Wynn and Tarbell, and why. The only other detail of the case, the final detail before we hit such a great investigative brick wall that we were forced to abandon the investigation, was this. Just a few days after we pulled that German machine gun out of Wolf's basement and were recovering the missing ballistic evidence from Tyler Wynn's fishing shack, three tiny bodies washed up on the banks of the St. Regis River, about 9 or 10 miles downstream. Little Sarah hadn't been the only kidnapped child on the smugglers' boat that night. There had been 3 more, 2 Canadian children and 1 American. All 3 had been riddled with those antique bullets bought by the late Wolf Tarbell. I figured that when they realized what they'd done, Tarbell and Wynne had to make it look like something it wasn't. But they couldn't have been working alone. It's impossible that they were working alone, because if they were, then who the hell did the exact same brutal thing to them in order to ensure their eternal silence? I might be Mohawk on my mother's side, but I don't subscribe to beliefs that involve things I can't see or touch. I don't believe any kind of spirit was responsible for what had happened to those people, be it the smugglers, their child captives, or those who killed them. But I do believe that there's someone out there. Maybe they're still on the reservation, maybe not, who out of blind hatred or lust for revenge did something truly unforgivable. And I'll live the rest of my life in regret that I couldn't bring them to justice. Maybe the story of why I couldn't bring them to justice could make for another chapter of my memoir, but I have no doubt that it'd make for a much sadder and much less unsettling kind of story than this one. My name's Koba. I'm a longtime listener, and I figured that I should finally just sit down and write out my story. I live with my family on the Yakama Indian Reservation here in Washington. I've lived here all my life, and the reality is a lot different than what you might read about or see on TV. There's a lot of natural beauty here, and that's definitely true. Even having grown up with the Cascades in the background anytime you're outside, you'd think I might be used to it by now. But every time your eyes wander while you're driving and you're out hunting or fishing, there's almost one of those wow moments, where the mountains catch the light in just the right way, or you come across a scene straight from a Hobbit movie. I love those, by the way. But beneath all that natural splendor, there's a lot of hardship and a lot of violence here on the res, especially when it comes to drugs and alcohol addiction. Drugs, particularly meth, have been a dark cloud hanging over this reservation for literally decades at this point. It's everywhere, seeping into every corner of people's lives. I've known good people, people with families, jobs, everything a person could want, have their entire lives swallowed up by it. It's not just a drug here. It's more like a disease that's put down roots throughout the community, leaving almost no one untouched. You see it in the empty, tired eyes of the young kids whose parents have been affected by it. And you see it in the empty, boarded-up houses that were once home to generations of the same family. And you see it in the same crime rates that just keep on climbing, without fail, year in and year out. As one old friend of mine put it, it takes normal, regular life and it turns into some kind of survival situation. And in survival situations, you got your predators, and where there's predators, there's prey. All the robberies, break-ins, and burglaries are bad enough, but the violence is by far the worst. It's not just the physical fights that you hear about, but the whole atmosphere of fear and distrust that it breeds. I've seen how meth can change people, how they lose themselves to paranoia, aggression, and eventually, insanity. Which leads me to a story that still sends shivers down my spine. Back when I was a kid, there was this school teacher who I'll just call Mrs. L. She was one of the good ones, the kind that fills you with the hope of the future. And she taught at the local school and had a way with the kids that made learning seem like fun and not a total drag. Her classroom was a sanctuary, a place where you could forget about all the bad things going on in the outside world. And Mrs. L lived in a small but cozy-looking home near the edge of town, where the houses start to thin out and the wild begins to take over. She was known for her kindness, often baking cookies for the kids or helping out at the community events, and was loved by everyone. Not just her students, but the whole community. But then one night, something truly tragic and terrible happened, but also something so twisted that it's still hard for me to wrap my head around, even all these years later. There was this guy, Nash, who everyone knew was deep into meth. He'd been in and out of trouble for years, but then one day he started acting even stranger than usual. and the word was that he thought people were out to get him, that he was being spied on, or some nonsense like that. But others could see what was happening to him clear as anything else. It was the meth, rotting his mind away, and not long after he seemed to lose it completely. One night, probably after a few days of binging on crystal, Nash walked out of his house and went walking around the res, all keyed up and psychotic. Everyone knew to lock their doors and to avoid all contact with him when he was acting like that, and usually speaking, he'd head straight back home once he started to come down and then stay indoors all night getting high. But what happened that night was beyond anyone's worst nightmare. In his meth-induced psychosis, Nash decided to break into the next house he came across, and the next house he came across belonged to our beloved Mrs. L. The details are pretty gruesome, something most of us can't even stomach talking about. He didn't just kill her. He ate parts of her body, driven by whatever twisted reality his meth-addled mind had constructed for him. Someone later said that he told the cops it was because he thought eating someone that pure would clean out his soul or something. I don't know how true that is, but it sure rings true, and that alone is chilling enough. The next morning, when Mrs. L didn't show up for school, people went over to check on her, and what they found was a scene from a horror movie. Nash was still there, in a state of confusion and terror, not even fully understanding what he'd done. I heard he attacked the folks who showed up, thinking that they were trying to sort of set him up for something. They managed to hold him off until the cops showed up. Then Nash was taken away. But the damage was already done, and it couldn't be undone either. An innocent life had been snuffed out forever. And as you can probably imagine, news of Mrs. L's murder shook the entire reservation to its core. It wasn't just the murder itself which got to people either. It was the realization of just how deep the drug problem had sunk. For weeks afterwards, there were meetings, talks, and vigils. People were scared, angry, and desperate for change. They talked about rehab, about bringing in more resources, about how to protect our community from falling further into the abyss. But change is very slow here. The meth continues to flow, and it finds new victims every single day. In the aftermath, we've seen some changes. A new rehab center opened, funded by tribal grants and donations. And we've learned to look after each other more, to notice when someone's slipping, and offer a hand before they fall too deep. There are more patrols, more community watch groups, and there's talk about bringing in educational programs to teach the youth about the dangers of drugs. We've held ceremonies, traditional healing sessions, where elders speak of our ancestors' resilience, reminding us that we're not the first to face such darkness. Every time I walk past Mrs. L's old house, now boarded up and silent, I'm reminded of what we lost and what we're fighting for. It's not just about stopping drug use, it's about reclaiming our community, our identity, and our future. The story of Mrs. L is a scar on our collective memory, but it's also a testament to our spirit and our commitment to not let the darkness define us. Mrs. L's memory lives on, not because of how horrifying her death was, but because of the light that she's shone into people's lives. Because here on the Yakama Reservation, we're more than our struggles. We're a people with a rich history, a deep culture, and a fierce will to survive and thrive despite the shadows that try to consume us. Nash, on the other hand, left a very different legacy. His story isn't just a cautionary tale. It's a reminder of how drugs can strip away humanity, turn a person into a monster they never wanted to be. In living here, you learn to be cautious. You keep your eyes open, not just for your own safety, but for your neighbors. We're a tight-knit community, but the drugs are like a slow poison. But there's resilience, too. We gather, we talk, we remember. And in our small ways, we try to rebuild what's been broken. I'm writing from the Navajo Nation Reservation, the place I've lived all my young life. I wanted to share a horrifying experience that began during what was supposed to be a peaceful walk with my old mutt, Mahi. We often take this one particular route, pacing through the red rock landscapes under the shadows of buttes and mesas that have stood guard over the land for centuries, They really are beautiful. But on this particular day, we came across a river that had turned murky, unlike really anything I'd ever seen before. The water, which once mirrored the sky, was now sort of a shade of green, with an oily sheen that made me feel almost nauseous just looking at it. Mai, who was curious as always, ran down to the edge of the water and started to drink from it. I managed to pull him away just for a few seconds, but the damage was already done. And over the next few days, his behavior changed dramatically. Mahi, who was once the friendliest dog ever, began to act very strangely. He started pacing, snarling at shadows, and even snapped at me when I tried to calm him down. His eyes were wild with a sort of rage and confusion, and it was hard to tell which at any one time. Feeling overwhelmed and out of my depth, I called my friend Niz. He's an ecological expert with a PhD. And Niz has done a lot of work on the impact of industrial pollution on indigenous lands. He's the kind of guy who can walk into a forest and tell you the story of its health just by listening to the birds and observing the flora. And he spent years advocating for environmental justice for Native American communities, making him pretty much the perfect person to call in this type of crisis. Niz arrived with a very calm demeanor, bringing along his mobile equipment to analyze the immediate environment. And when we returned to that river, it was even more alarming in daylight, covered in this very oily film that seemed like it was suffocating the life out of the water. Niz took some samples, and he got to work. Back at my place, his equipment revealed alarming levels of chemicals that shouldn't have been there. He explained that the chemicals could cause neurological damage, which would explain Mai's altered behavior. That night, despite all of our efforts to keep Mai calm and secure, he passed away in his sleep. And the chemicals in the water had done their damage, leading to a very peaceful end on what had become a terrifying nightmare. And losing Mai was a very terrible wake-up call, not just for me, but for our entire community. It was then that I began speaking with more people, some of which mentioned seeing suspicious activities at night near the water source. Niz and I decided to investigate. We hid near the river, and sure enough, just before midnight, a truck would come by, quiet as can be. Men in these dark clothes unloading barrels, and then they began pouring substances directly into the river. Niz, with observation skills, noted down every little detail, furious at the blatant environmental crimes that were obviously happening right up close to us. And the next day, we presented these findings to the tribal council. Niz explained the scientific implications of that contamination, and the council was hesitant at first, perhaps not wanting to believe the extent of the intrusion on their land. But the strange behaviors of local animals, not just Mahi, were obvious proof enough that something was very wrong. The council then called the EPA, and soon, government officials were all over the land. And they confirmed what we feared. Toxic waste from some corporation had been dumped into the river, thinking no one would notice. The waste contained chemicals that could alter behavior, cause aggression, and lead to long-term health issues for the community. And the news spread pretty quickly, igniting a fire of outrage and action. The company faced fines and lawsuits and were forced to clean up the contamination. However, the process was very long, and in the meantime, we had to find alternative water sources, relying on deliveries and rainwater collection. And the community started healing, setting up systems to continuously monitor our water. Niz came by more often, not just to help, but to educate our people on environmental stewardship, turning his expertise into community empowerment, and he taught us how to use traditional knowledge alongside modern science to protect our land. And we established a committee for environmental safety to watch over our natural resources. It wasn't just about water, it was about rights, our land, and the preservation of our way of life. And we learned to be vigilant, and to question things, and to look out for things, and to protect it. Now when I look at that river, it's clear again, thanks to our fight. And we fought for this, for our peace, and we'll keep fighting. Because we now understand, more than ever, the importance of vigilance. And I'll never forget my pup. A reminder of what we lost and why we must continue that battle. Every day as I walk by where Maui used to sleep, I think about our responsibility to the land and each other. We can't let this happen again. We need to educate the young ones about our heritage and our duty to protect it. It's not just about surviving. It's about living well with respect and dignity, on our terms, and not anyone else's. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sunday and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over at my email, letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. If you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, who owns the moon?